I'm Tina, I'm an alcoholic. And I am grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Congratulations to the birthday people, and I want to say welcome to the newcomers to a new way of life. This is a wonderful way of life, and I'm very grateful to be here. My sobriety date this time is February 19th, 2004. And I say this time because my drinking career has been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like a normal person. And I spent a lot of my life trying to control my drinking and my using. And it's a cunning and baffling and powerful disease. My story is what it used to be like. Is not a lot different than a lot of the stories I hear here. I came from an alcoholic family. I saw a lot of violence and destruction caused from alcoholism, and I swore I was never going to drink or be an alcoholic. And I started drinking at 14, and right after I got violently ill and sick and threw up all night long, I was trying to control not getting sick. And it was a few short years, you know, after I started being able to hold my booze that I was trying to control my drinking and stop drinking. And I realized, you know, I was powerless over alcohol. And, you know, when I was 20 years old, I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with my father. And he 12-stepped me. And I spent from the age of 20 to 42 going in and out of this program. And I want to tell the newcomers, you are the most important people in this room. And it's a very, very painful way to live your life to do that, to go in and out and in and out and in and out. You never have to have another sobriety date. This can be your only one. You know, I have this meditation book, and in the back of it, I've had it since 1987. And I can't tell you how many dates have been scratched out. You know, I thought there was something wrong with me. I just couldn't get this program, you know. I would go out, and I would come in and get some time, and then, you know, pick up a drink or a drug, and it would seem to work for a little bit, or, you know, I couldn't control it. Bad things didn't always happen. And but like somebody, I've heard people saying here that when bad things did happen, I was usually drinking or using. And in 1987, I finally, you know, I had twin children at the time, and I didn't want my kids to see a drunken mother. And I was driving drunk with my kids in the car, and I was doing a lot of other things. And so I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, I really made a conscious effort. I got a sponsor, and I started going to a lot of meetings. I lived in Sacramento at the time, and I was going to the Bikers, Bankers, Boozers, and Bimbos meeting downtown Sacramento. And, you know, hour and a half meetings, and I was secretary of a meeting, and I got a really great sponsor. And she used to introduce herself by, she would say, "I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Bonnie, and if I forget what I am, it doesn't matter who I am." And I was, you know, that woman, I remember trying to track her down, and I couldn't find her. But, you know, so, when I got sober in 1987, I didn't, you know, at that time, I never thought that I was ever going to use or drink. And like I said, I had kids and a great life, and I was going to college. And, you know, so years passed by, and, you know, mid-90s or whatever, and I graduated college. But I remember, like, right around 5 years, I stopped going to meetings, you know. And pretty soon, you know, I got in a car accident. And I started taking some Vicodin. And I know this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but I need to share this because when our readings talk about switching and the things that we do to control our drinking, I thought nothing of taking a handful of Vicodin and sucking it down with O'Doul's and thinking I was sober. And so, you know, my thing was switching from alcohol to other substances. And I did that for a long, long time. I did that from 1994 to 2002 when I was finally arrested. 2001, excuse me, when I was finally arrested. And I spent a lot of time trying to get those substances. You know, eventually I picked up alcohol, and I was, you know, doing a lot of different substances, and I was flying from Northern California down here to go to Tijuana. I'd heard about getting pharmaceutical drugs over there, and I found a doctor that would give me anything I wanted. And I was a mess, but, you know, I was able to function at a certain level. I was able to function in society. That's why it's so cunning. And I was a mom, and I was a wife, and I was like, you know, hiding this from my husband, flying down here on a monthly basis to get these drugs, getting hammered on the plane, going into Tijuana, wandering around, a woman by myself, not single, but, you know, drunk in Tijuana. And I did that for a long time. Eventually moved my family down here, and it just was such a hassle to fly, you know. I convinced my husband to, you know, let's move down here. I was closer to the connection in Tijuana, and we moved next to a winery, and you know, it was miserable. And I finally, you know, for me, jobs always fixed me for a minute. You know, I have this whole portfolio of creative work that I've put together throughout the years, and I can look through that, and it's like this time frame of things I was doing in my life, and my using, and going into rehab, and, you know, so, you know, a career seemed to fix me for a while. I went to work for a high-tech PR agency here up in San, you know, and then I'm still doing this, going to a bunch of different doctors, going to Tijuana, drinking all the time. My life is a mess, and I had this impending doom. I knew that something was going to, you know, just crash on me, and I did. I eventually crashed my nice Mustang, and, you know, and then I, you know, 3 days before Father's Day in 1998, I abandoned my family. I had picked up using a lot of speed at the time, so I would, like, do speed, and I don't know how I could, like, even meet clients and do a lot of speed and then have to drink myself to sleep so I would, you know, could function at some level. And, you know, and then from 1998 to 2001, I fell into this world of incomprehensible demoralization and abuse and drugs and crime and drunkenness and, you know, just ugliness, and did things that you're eligible to, that I had, you know, never in my wildest dreams imagined would happen to, that I would do. And at the very, very end, right before I was arrested in 2001, thrown into a court program, I'll get sober here real quick, and I was certifiably insane. I had been in 5-point restraints. I was a crazy woman walking the streets of San Diego talking to you. I couldn't stay out of, you know, 5-point restraints and straight jackets, and I just was crazy. I was psychotic and wandering the streets, and, you know, finally got popped and thrown in, you know, that my last stop was like the room in jail that's, you know, they give you a padded suit. It's not a padded room. And there's a hole in the ground, and they don't give you silverware or toilet paper, you know, and it's the degradation. You're like at the basic animal level. And I knew that, it's funny, I remember, I was laying there, and they gave me some Vicodin, and it's like, don't you know that's where it all started? I that thought crossed my mind as I'm laying in the cell, and they're giving it to me to help me sleep. And then I went into this wonderful program that helped, well, it wasn't wonderful at the time, but a court-ordered program. But that's where the unmanageability was in my life. I had to have everybody managing my life. I was psychotic. I was crazy. I had to go under inpatient rehab program. You know, I could see I was powerless. And I had to, like, find some concept of a higher power. You know, I could totally understand the second step. And I really wanted to believe that there was something that could make me sane again, because I thought that I was never going to come back. You take away all the drugs, and I just, you know, and I was still having really spinning, my thoughts were spinning all the time. And the alcohol, take away the drugs and the alcohol. And, you know, and then the third step, you know, I had to find some power that I could turn my life over to, and made a decision to turn my will and my life, and I actually learned that that's your thoughts and your actions, over to a higher power, you know. And then I started doing the fourth step, and with, you know, and I you know, talked about, I learned about my resentments and my fears and my sexual harms, and, you know, and I met with my sponsor doing my fifth step, and I realized, you know, I'm not all that bad. I'm not all that good, but I'm not all that bad. You know, but that's humility, because I always thought humility was thinking you think you're too, you think too highly of yourself. But I also learned that if you think you're a piece of shit, you're not very humble either. So it's like finding this right-sized, you know, being right-sized. And, you know, and I learned when I did the fifth step that the wrongs are the same thing as your character defects and your shortcomings. You know, Bill just liked to switch up the words a little bit, you know. And so with the help of my sponsor, I was able to, like, see my part and stuff, and then, you know, become entirely ready to have my defects of character, my shortcomings removed. And I sat for a long time in the seventh step because I didn't think I was worthy. I didn't think I was worthy of having God's love, you know, my higher power's love in my life. And thank God the eighth and ninth step are where they're at, because when I came into recovery, there was so much, I was that tornado, there was so much wreckage. I had just destroyed so many people's lives, and I owed the IRS, I owed the Franchise Tax Board, I owed the Social Security Administration, I owed a bank money, not to mention all the people I had harmed, you know. But at that point, you know, okay, I had some of these steps behind me, and I was able to put that list together, and I was able to, like, start making my amends, and made it to my daughter and my ex-husband and some other people in my life. And I remember I kept apologizing to my kids and my husband over and over, and my daughter said something to me like, "Mom, you know, we've forgiven you. You got to forgive yourself." And that's where, like, the ninth step, where it talks about, you know, our promises, you know. And I love those promises. And then, you know, the 10th step is page 86 and 87. They drilled that into my head and went to the place that I was at, you know, doing that more searching, you know, and admitting, I can admit when I'm wrong now a little more quickly, you know, than I could before. And you know, I could see when I'm wrong, but I'm not always wrong, because I used to think that I was always wrong and it was always my fault, you know. And the 11th step sought through prayer and meditation to prove a conscious contact. I go to an 11th step meeting every week, and I pray to my higher power, and I talk to my higher power all day long, and I'm learning to meditate. And then 12, having had a spiritual awakening, is doing all these steps, you know. I can carry this message to the newcomer. I can go to I do H&I at Las Colinas. I carry the message to women in jail, and it's a beautiful thing. You know, I came in here a broken woman, and I remember I had no hope. I remember screaming to my counselor at the rehab facility that I went to. I said, the only thing that's ever going to change me is an act of God, and that's really what it took. And you know, to be restored to sanity, to have some peace and serenity in my life, to be able to go back to graduate school and earn a degree, to, like, get a job and pass a security clearance, and I've done all that in recovery. My dreams keep, you know, surpassing my wildest dreams, being in recovery. You know, they said, make a list. I'll wrap it up here. Make a list of the things you want when you get in recovery. And, you know, that list has already been, you know, a blessing. So thanks for letting me share.